Good day and welcome to the National Foundation for American Policy on Recommendations for Employment-Based Immigration and Naturalization Conference Call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to the moderator, Mr. Stuart Anderson. Please go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Stuart Anderson, Executive Director of the National Foundation for American Policy, a nonpartisan public policy research organization started in 2003, focused primarily on trade and immigration. The studies we're releasing today can be found on our website at www.nfap.com. The two studies are the result of a type of crowdsourcing. The studies involve a total of 18 authors and co-authors from many of the country's leading law firms and organizations involved with immigration. The impetus for the studies was President Barack Obama's executive order in January, calling on agencies to conduct a full review of regulations and policies, particularly in the President's words, quote, outdated regulations that stifle job creation and make our economy less competitive. Immigration is a key component of a country's competitiveness, and the right policies help keep jobs in the United States in particular, and make companies better able to compete globally. Looking long term, the two studies, one on employment-based immigration and the other on naturalization, can serve as a blueprint for reform for either this or a future administration. And these are reforms that do not require Congress passing a new law. Much of what appears in the two reports was also submitted during the regulatory comment period opened up by the Obama administration. Now, in the report on employment-based immigration, the question is asked, does President Obama realize his immigration agencies are making American companies less competitive? The problems in employment-based immigration are many. Over the past several months, employers have faced the reality of agency actions that delay projects, force companies to go without valuable employees, and push work outside the United States, the report notes. Today, applications for skilled foreign nationals are routinely greeted by U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service adjudicators with costly and time-consuming requests for evidence, is the term. Immigration attorneys say they've never seen the process for approving applications this arduous. In addition, both the State Department and the Immigration Service routinely deny or delay applications for companies simply to transfer into the U.S. existing employees with specialized knowledge on L-1 visas, which is another signal to keep more work abroad in the first place. The oversight process has become more burdensome as well. In the past year, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services has conducted 15,000 on-site audits of employers that hire skilled foreign-born professionals. Many large companies report being visited almost monthly. Now, here are some of the key recommendations in the report on employment-based immigration. First is to curtail requests for evidence and adjudicate cases in a timely manner. Next is to limit redundant audits and instead engage in focused enforcement. Another recommendation is to fundamentally reform labor certification, which is a key part of the green card process that now can take a year or more and cost over $10,000. Another recommendation is to allow skilled professionals to file early for adjustment of status prior to when a visa number is available for their green card. This will help the country retain skilled foreign nationals by giving them greater labor mobility. Some of these folks have been waiting for many years, and because of the way the rules work, they often can't be promoted within companies or certainly go to another company without having to start their application over. This would also actually help spouses be able to work as well. Now, to discourage illegal immigration, agencies should make visa rules less bureaucratic on the lower end of the visa spectrum for H-2A visas for agricultural workers and H-2B visas for non-agricultural workers. And to foster startups, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services should rescind its January 2010 immigration memo that prohibited a company from petitioning for its founder, especially since, unfortunately, the agency's recently announced modifications in the memo will benefit relatively few potential foreign-born entrepreneurs. Now, the Obama administration receives higher remarks on naturalization than in other areas of immigration policy. But among the recommendations in the report on naturalization are to consider fee reform and streamlining that brings down the price of applying for naturalization, revise and simplify the language in both the naturalization form and instructions, and restore off-site naturalization interviews at local community centers, and there are other recommendations that we'll be talking about later in the call. We're now going to hear from four distinguished speakers. They all have very impressive biographies and are important leaders in the world of immigration policy. In the interest of time, I'm going to list just their affiliations when introducing them for short remarks, and then we'll open up for questions. The first speaker is Randall K. Johnson, who is Senior Vice President for Labor, Immigration, and Employee Benefits at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Randy?
Yeah, thanks, Stuart. Let me just compliment you on pulling a comprehensive report together and making it, well-documented but still readable and I think making sense to people who aren't steeped in immigration. So it's certainly going to be helpful as we work on these issues with the administration on Capitol Hill or even with the presidential campaign. So, again, thanks. I'm just going to talk about two areas, I guess one very broad and one extremely simple, and yet I would call them both in the category of low-hanging fruit in the sense of neither takes legislative changes on Capitol Hill, and it's one of those peculiar areas where I've always been perplexed as why the administration, whether Republican or Democrat, just doesn't do it. But one is called the 214B issue, and I think many people on the call probably recognize that a so-called non-immigrant can be denied his or her non-immigrant visa if the consular officer believes that that person has, in fact, an intent to immigrate to the United States, i.e. stay in the United States permanently. And, of course, the difference is why lots of people think everyone who's come to the United States is an immigrant. There are, in fact, two categories, non-immigrants and immigrants, immigrants being the ones who want to come here permanently. So we're really talking about non-immigrants' visas. And this is an area where we see broad denials of applications to come to the United States, basically because the consular officer has full discretion to say, well, you know, I just don't think you have enough assets back in your home country to draw you back. You don't have enough family. I don't like the kind of answers you're giving me. And so I think you have an intent to immigrate to the United States and stay permanently, so visa denied. Now, we're not debating whether or not that's in fact a criteria or valid criteria. I think our concern has always been that an officer has such complete discretion and the, of course, adverse impact of that decision is so huge that there ought to be some sort of at least informal but clear type of review within the consular, the consulate or at some exterior location. Where there's someone else looking at the decision made by the consular officer to say, look, in this case, I think we need to take a second look, and we need to give this person either another chance to clarify that they, in fact, do not intend to stay in the United States, or indeed, you know, maybe, Fred, you just had a bad day, and I think you need to look at this file again. Again, the point is the impact of the decision is so huge, but it's completely discretionary with the consular officer. We believe there ought to be some sort of secondary level of review, and that's not asking for a lot. We're not saying there should be some sort of review in the courts, some sort of even an administrative law judge type review. All we're saying is that the State Department ought to say, look, everyone has a bad day, and we need to have some sort of check on this absolute discretion that leads to denials under 214B. Frankly, I've been asking that here at the Chamber for several years. It's been earlier reports that we've submitted to the State Department. Sometimes they'll say, oh, we've got that kind of level of review. We just don't really codify it anywhere. I've never been able to get a straight answer on that question. I think they need to set up some sort of semi-formal process so there is a level of review. And again, not a straight check-in on the State Department, but just some kind of check on this absolute discretion which currently exists. Now, that's a big issue, but it's a big area, and it's important, but it's also easy to, it's an easy fix. It wouldn't cost a ton of money, we don't think. And it would give, you know, the United States, I think, a better image of fairness abroad, and if people get denied, at least they know they've had a fair shot at the brass ring. Sort of moving from that broad issue, and I'll finish up, Stuart, to, you know, a real minor issue, but I think shows you how ridiculous some things can be. In the current immigration world is a requirement that when an employer recruits for a U.S. worker when under the labor certification process, they must absolutely have an advertisement in a print media of wide circulation despite the underlying job that they're recruiting for. So, for example, an employer who is recruiting, say, for a PhD in nuclear physics or something, must put a print ad in the New York Times, even though that's extremely expensive, and the chances of finding a PhD in nuclear physics through an advertisement in the New York Times are virtually null. We think that absolute requirement ought to be stricken from the regulations and that employers ought to be able to use a more legitimate, reasonable avenue of recruitment for U.S. workers. That's one of those duh moments, and when you tell people that, people say, well, of course that ought to be fixed, but it still continues on the books. So those are just two examples of kind of moving from the broad to the specific that we think this administration should be able to tackle and would have a significant impact on improving the system from all viewpoints.
Great. Well, thank you. Thank you, Randy. Next, we'll hear from Austin Fragman, who's chairman of the American Council on International Personnel and partner and founder of Fragman, Del Rey, Bernstein, and Lowy. Austin?
Thank you, Stuart. And first, I too would like to acknowledge the fine work that Stuart and NFAP have expended in putting these reports together. They're a real contribution to the thinking in the field. And of course, the goal here really is to for the administration to adopt policies to win the competition for top global talent. And the reason this is important is to increase competitiveness through creating jobs. And we all know that immigrants have played a very key role, particularly high-skilled immigrants, in innovation and through leveraging needed skill sets, we can create jobs. So I think that that's a major focus of the administration. Unfortunately, the policies to date have the opposite effect and discouraged high-skill migration through procedural roadblocks as well as adopting very high bars in terms of evidentiary requirements to qualify for these various categories. In fact, some of the restrictive interpretations apply to the categories where the most highly qualified immigrants attempt to acquire permanent residence. For instance, categories that provide for outstanding researchers or persons of extraordinary ability or international managers and executives. So it's ironic that the people who, as I say, are the applicants who are the most qualified sometimes experience the highest bar in terms of qualification and of course, frustration not only through legal interpretation, but also through evidentiary barriers. And on that front, what the USCIS has to do is to accept what we would call a credible or probative evidence to show that the applicant qualifies, as opposed to basically requiring the applicant to obtain difficult-to-obtain primary evidence, payroll records for the last 2 years from abroad, personnel records from the foreign employer, et cetera. Another proposal of ours through ACIP, which we feel very strongly about, is establishing a trusted employer program, which essentially is to register companies that are volume users of immigration visas, and more particularly companies with run immigration programs and have continuing needs who have very good track records as compliant employers. And the idea here is to ask for information from the company to establish all the basics to do away with the necessity of going back and requesting further evidence and to simplify the filings. This would create a much higher level of transparency, efficiency, and predictability. And interestingly, both the United Kingdom and Australia already have these registration programs. Also, these programs can be audit-driven, where the government can require a great deal of information on a post-audit basis or in the audit process to be able to assure themselves that these programs are really first-rate and achieving the goals that they are designed to achieve. Finally, this would save money for the government because they would not have to go through all the steps in the adjudicatory process, not have to ask for much needed much repeated information such as copies of annual reports, 10-Ks, things of that sort, organizational charts. So it would allow the government to focus its resources on enforcement and on those petitioners that do pose a problem to the system. Another idea that would be very helpful, we always hear about creating a fast track to permanent residence for persons who have advanced degrees from U.S. universities. Well, of course, that's a legislative solution, but it is possible to do much more administratively. There are schedules of occupations which are in short supply and therefore don't require going through the advertisements and whatnot that that were just mentioned by Randy. By expanding the occupations to include STEM fields, particularly with a person as an advanced degree from a U.S. university, would be very helpful. And if you couple that with allowing graduates of U.S. universities to remain in optical practical training and allowed them to travel on optical practical training while they pursued residence, that would be very helpful as well. So those are just a few ideas, and of course the papers have many more. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Austin. Next we'll hear from William Stock, who is Secretary of the American Immigration Lawyers Association and a founding partner of Clasco, Rolon, Stock, and Seltzer. Bill?
Thank you very much, Stuart. I wanted to focus attention on something that Andy Mayorkas, actually, Ellie Mayorkas proposes, recently made a big point of, which was coming out with something, administrative changes that really foster the agency's responsiveness to the needs of entrepreneurs. And I wanted to highlight the reason that guidance was necessary. So far, we have seen a situation where smaller companies, startup companies, entrepreneurs who want to create a business in the United States don't have very many good options to do so. All right, we have individuals who are graduating from American schools. They come and see me, and they say, well, what are my options because I really want to start a business here, either myself or with some of my colleagues from school. And a lot of times we're telling them, well, look, the visa that most people use for professional-level employment, like the software development, for example, you want to do, that's an H-1B visa. But if you found the company, the Immigration Service right now is going to say that the company can't sponsor one of its founders. That's a huge barrier to allowing that business to get founded in the United States instead of back home in the UK or back home in India or back home wherever the student comes from. Similarly, if a business wants to relocate itself to the United States, some of the most difficult cases that we handle in our office are for new offices of foreign companies that are trying to open up a business here in the United States. And it is now worse than it has been in the 17 years that I've been practicing immigration law in terms of the level of scrutiny that you have to provide if you're opening a new office. More importantly, and what can really be a challenge, is that even once the new office has been certified, there's a regulatory procedure which allows for a new office to be sort of given a little bit less scrutiny, but then it's only good for 1 year. After 1 year, you have to go back. And it is now exceedingly difficult to get an entrepreneurial business, a new business, over that hump of, you know, just 1 year later, does the Immigration Service, you know, they expect that a business that's only a year old will have done everything that businesses operating for many, many years in the United States have done. We also look at visas for investors in the United States. There are treaties which allow for investors to come to the United States and create businesses where, as long as they're making a substantial investment, which is defined as one that's not just marginal, not just for allowing the investor to work in the United States, that they're allowed to get those visas. Well, you know what? The BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, some of the fastest growing economies in the world, guess what? Investors from those countries can't use the e-visa to come here and found a business in the United States. And so increasingly, we're seeing, if you've read the papers by Vivek Wadhwa, he has actually documented that entrepreneurs for those countries are opting to take their businesses and go home to found it in other countries, which we really think is to the detriment of the U.S. economy. So, I think having an awareness and an openness that the mission of the Immigration Services is to really foster the interests of the United States, which include being welcoming to folks who want to make their lives here, who want to make their businesses here, really is one of the biggest changes that the administration can make.
Great. Thank you, Bill. And now we're going to shift gears a little bit and hear a little bit about what happens after an immigrant gets here and wants to become a citizen. We're going to hear from Kevin Appleby, Director of the Office of Migration and Refugee Policy at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Kevin?
Thanks, Stuart, and thanks for these reports. I'm going to change the subject just a bit to talk about the naturalization process in our country, which is the dream of many immigrants who come here and come to this country. They want to become U.S. citizens, and history has shown the persons who naturalize as U.S. citizens become great contributors to our nation, including business entrepreneurs, as they have worked hard to obtain their citizenship, and they appreciate the benefits it bestows, sometimes even more so than U.S. citizens born in this country. And our government also has an interest in integrating immigrants into the country and making them full members of our society. So there are shared goals here in the naturalization process, but what we've seen over the past two decades is that it's become more difficult, not easier, for immigrants to obtain U.S. citizenship, particularly those who might be of low income or have special needs. For example, in the last two decades, naturalization fees have increased 650%. Now it costs $680 to apply for naturalization. That's above and beyond the nearly $1,000 it costs to get a green card. Now, that might not seem like a lot of money to many Americans, but for an immigrant family that has multiple members and may be economically challenged, it has a chilling effect. They might delay naturalization applications in order to improve their homes or to buy food to put on the table. So it creates a harder choice for them. For example, when the fee was raised in 2007, the next year only 1 million legal permanent residents naturalized, and there were 8 million that were eligible. So it had an effect, and it dropped over 30% those who were applying for citizenship. As the National Immigration Forum recommends in the report, the USCIS, Citizenship and Immigration Services, which administers naturalization process, could look at the fee structure again and see how they can more evenly apply fees. Or, and this is a legislative concern, Congress could consider appropriating money for such costs as adjudication for refugee and asylee applications or infrastructure costs. This particular agency, Citizenship and Immigration Services, 90% of their costs come out of fees. And we need to look at that again and see, is that a balanced way to fund this important service and this important process to our country? Immigrants with special needs also face barriers, as is pointed out by the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society in the report. For example, the naturalization form is often complicated for immigrants who might be proficient in English but might not have the advanced English that they need to understand the form. A lot of legal terms are used, and the instructions are very complicated. USCIS should certainly look at that again to see if they can simplify it even more. Also, under immigration law, adjudicators for citizenship can give due consideration to the background and learning ability of an immigrant in determining whether they should become a citizen in an interview or in looking at their citizenship test. Often that's not evenly applied across the country. Additionally, as Stuart mentioned at the outset, there should be more access to interviews at different sites around the country. Often immigrants have a hard time getting to the locations of the USCIS offices, and you can also have sites in communities. Certainly you could have them in churches or in parishes, which we would be more than happy to accommodate. Finally, the Immigration Policy Center looks at the issue more broadly in the report. They talk about a national integration plan or a national integration strategy. In our history, certainly immigrants have integrated into this country very well, helped predominantly by the private sector and by churches. There's really never been a coherent national integration policy which invests resources in trying to prepare new immigrants to become American citizens. Even so, immigrants integrate at the same rate they have in our history. They integrate at the same rate. But we do a better job of providing more English instruction, for example, in communities, more civics instruction to immigrants so they're better prepared to become U.S. citizens and to return and to invest in this country the way they can. So that's something I particularly note in the report, which is something that we would recommend that the administration look into. So those are the main recommendations of the report on naturalization. There are other aspects of it I would encourage you all to look at, and we will also be encouraging the administration to look at these recommendations as well.
Great. Thank you, Kevin. And now we're going to open up for questions, and our operator will come back on with instructions.
At this time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star and the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Once again, that's star 1 to ask a question. We'll pause for a moment to assemble the queue. And we'll take our first question from Charlie Erickson with Hispanic Link News Service.
And my associate here will ask the question.
This question is for Mr. Johnson. I wonder if there are any numbers of jobs that are going unfilled as a result of this arduous process that the immigrant applicants are going through in order to get their visas?
Well, there's about a 93% denial rate for the 214B intent to immigrate issue I mentioned, and we know that a lot of those are B1 visitor visas, well, B1, B2 business visitor visas, and the B1 business visa are people who are coming from other countries to this country to look at products, for example, to buy from American manufacturers, to get trained on that kind of equipment, and take that back and purchase the product in the United States, sign contracts, and then, of course, return to their home country. So I don't have direct numbers on sort of the adverse effect of how many jobs would be created if we knew how many were denied under the 214B intent to immigrate issue. But if you're denying a certain number of people from coming here to seal deals with American employers, we know it's some number. But, yeah, I can't categorize. I do know, for example, that Caterpillar had to move their training center to another country because they could not bring in the people they needed to train on the equipment that they were selling to customers overseas because of denials under B1.
Thank you.
Can you be a little more detailed on that as to why people are being denied? You give one example, but I really didn't get any quantification out of it.
I mean, some of the attorneys might also be able to give examples from their client base.
Well, they're being denied under the broad basis of, as I, as a consular officer, think you are not intending to go back to your home country, and that, in fact, you are going to abandon your visa and stay in the United States permanently. And that's what the broad discretionary test is. And so it really doesn't have to be more detailed if we had more information on the State Department or we had a secondary level of review, we would have more information. Now, it could be that all these are legitimate denials. We don't know. But if they're legitimate, then there shouldn't be a problem with having a sort of secondary level of review, which is basically what we're asking for.
Okay.
Okay, we'll take our next question from Juan Esparza with Viva en Alvão.
Yes, I know that immigration reform has become a controversial topic over the last few years. Any way to gauge the public appetite for this administrative changes that the group is proposing that the Obama administration could do without having to go through Congress?
I could at least start with that by saying that I think many of those, as I think the speakers outlined, are not controversial. Many are not, and that they could be done without creating a large outcry, but they would have a very positive impact, whether some of the things in the naturalization area and some of the things that affect employers, that have been described. I mean, I think one of the things we talked about at the top about the, changing the adjustment status rule, so allowing people to file prior to, their green card number coming up, would have a huge effect on thousands of people waiting for green cards, but again, doesn't mean any new numbers or anyone new is coming into the country, so it doesn't raise the type of concerns that you often hear that people express on immigration.
Yeah, this is Kevin. In terms of naturalization, we found in a lot of our research and talking to Catholics and others that one of the concerns of the American public is that new immigrants aren't integrating at the same rate as they have in the past, that they stay in their own communities, that they do not want to become Americans. And this is quite to the contrary, is the reality. They do want to become Americans by and large. And Americans want them to become Americans, we've found. They feel like if they're fully integrated, then they're going to be paying all their taxes, going to be part of the community. They're going to be in a level playing field with others who are American citizens. So we found that policies that improve the naturalization process are well received by the American public. They're not rejected by them. So I think the Obama administration would be wise. I think it would be politically savvy and on their part to start an integration plan or an integration strategy over the next year or so. I think that would be something that would be well received by the American public.
Yeah, Austin Fragman here. A simple example would be making an announcement that the administration was going to adopt policies to encourage graduates of U.S. universities with advanced degrees to particularly in areas like science and engineering and whatnot, persons with masters and PhDs to remain in the U.S. We've already made the country, that is, our educational system, funding of the educational system, et cetera, has already made a major investment in these individuals. So, and we all know that highly educated and highly skilled immigrants have a tremendous track record in the U.S. in terms of innovation and job creation through leveraging those skills. So I think when you couch the argument in those terms, it becomes a strong argument that would in fact win popular support. So that's just one example, and I think a lot of it's the way the way it's presented.
Thank you.
And we'll take our next question from Alex Wagner with Huffington Post.
Thanks for having the call. I guess I wonder in the broader context how, I think it was 2 weeks ago USCIS announced, they were trying to improve the transparency around H-1B applications and I think EB-2. That seemed to be sort of the opening volley in taking to the administrative track to improve our immigration policy. I guess how do you grade the I mean, this is following on the last question, but how would you grade the administration's interest in doing the stuff on the administrative level, obviously, as opposed to the legislative track, which seems to be going nowhere?
I guess I could start. I mean, Krista Williams, the executive director of AILA, noted that when in announcing the policy, it took a number of months, and then the administration had a comment period for ideas, but they only had a 30-day comment period, and across all agencies almost simultaneously. And I think, that kind of gave a little indication that they weren't that interested in everyone else's ideas. Because obviously, for something as large as sort of any type of improvement that could be made to any agency, 30 days doesn't seem like an awful lot of time for people to come up with, well-thought-out ideas. Although we were able to submit comments, ourselves, gathered from other folks. Many that are in the report. So far we've seen one, it's been about 8 months since the president's announcement, and so far we've seen one small thing on immigration that actually wasn't even a regulatory change, that was kind of a clarification.
You're saying that the appetite may not be as robust as you had hoped for?
Well, again, the president and some of the people around him had the idea to do this, but, the actual changes, unless there's a lot of follow-through by the White House, has kind of been left to the agencies themselves. And, I think it still remains to be seen, how interested they are in making, serious reforms. I'll let the other speakers comment on that as well, I guess.
Well, Austin Fragman here again. I would just say that obviously we welcome anything the administration is willing to do to facilitate some of these ideas. In the scheme of all the different ideas that have floated and the recommendations that in some of the suggestions we've been making in our comments, are far more significant than the few concepts that the administration put on the table. So I would just suggest that there's a lot more they can do, and a lot of it has to do with whether you're trying to adopt restrictive interpretations and create evidentiary barriers that frustrate achieving the result of acquiring work permits and permission to stay in the U.S. or whatever, or whether your policy is the opposite, which is to try to encourage qualified, high-skilled immigrants to remain in the United States. And there are a lot of different categories, and I think we alluded to some of them. But there are a lot of opportunities, and there are a lot of highly qualified people. But what's happening is that these restrictive interpretations, whether it's on the Labor Department side of requiring ads in the Sunday paper, or just the standard that they use, that you have to hire a minimally qualified American as opposed to the best qualified candidate, and you look at the standard they set for a person to qualify as an outstanding researcher, why try to, somebody has PhD credentials working in a highly technical field, biopharma research, et cetera. I mean, why try to think of ways you can turn that case down instead of seeing that this is a highly qualified person that's doing really significant work and say, yeah, they're an outstanding researcher. So you can draw the line, where a certain amount of flexibility in terms of the way you interpret these various categories, which results in, where the line is, so to speak, which are how outstanding you have to be, outstanding compared to what. Outstanding compared to Albert Einstein, compared to someone who doesn't have a PhD in a top research job with a major company. So, I mean, I think that's where I'd say we lose the administration in terms of their purported desire to be helpful in this context.
Thanks.
And I would say too that certainly Director Mayorkas has gotten the importance of the issue. If you look at the blog he recently did 2 weeks ago on the problem of entrepreneurship and encouraging them, I think what we see is, you know, pushing that through the agency. While the director can say, hey, we're looking at this issue, until it's actually in the training materials, until it's actually changing the adjudicator's field manual that guides how the decisions get made, we haven't really accomplished anything. So, you know, obviously, great marks for raising the issue and for pushing it on the agenda, but now it's really got to be delivered to where it's going to have some effect on businesses out in the field.
Just quickly, this is Kevin. On the naturalization side, I would certainly give them a passing grade. They raised fees on other applications in 2010, and they did not raise a naturalization fee, which was helpful. They've also given out integration grants to local communities and NGOs to help with English and civics instruction, and that's been helpful. I would say that on the access side, they need to look at their what they've done and improve access in terms of interviews, in terms of those who have English challenges, things like that.
Thanks a lot.
And we'll take our next question from Betty Lynn with World Journal.
Hi, thank you for having the call. This is for Randy. Did you say that there's a 93% denial rate on the basis of 214B, and do you have a time period for that? And compared to in the past, like do you have any other figure on the past denial rate? And also, I think like last week there was a conference call and people concerned that if some people already file for immigration if apply for a B1 visa, there's higher denial rate even if they come for Christmas or spring break. I don't know whether you can address to that. And for Austin, I'd like to know whether you are pushing for any like legislation concerning H1 or L1. Thank you.
Yeah, the 93% of denials are based on the 214B denial. And you were asking, is that a greater rate than in the past?
Right.
Right, has it gone up since the past?
We don't have the specifics. We don't have the specifics of each year. I mean, I don't know that comment. But
so
I'm looking at my expert here. Go ahead, Amy.
Anecdotally, business visitor and tourism visa applications are being denied more frequently today at a higher rate this year than in prior years. But we don't actually have the data. We didn't do an analysis to compare many different years as to how many denials are under this general withdrawal of the 214B compared to the overall denial rate. But we do know from our member companies that in this fiscal year, there are a higher rate of B1 business visitor denial than in the past. And you're correct that if someone already has an application pending for permanent resident status, they are definitely more likely to be denied to be a visitor, even if they can document or they think that they've documented that they're just coming for a visit for a holiday.
On the question you asked about H&L legislation, I think the first concern of the business community is just to make certain that none of the more restrictive proposals that have been introduced or have been floated as amendments or whatnot are adopted. So that the first order of business is to make sure that there isn't regression in either of those visa categories. That of course brings up the question of whether the cap should be extended. We know that the cap increased, and we know that the cap wasn't reached right away, but that's not a good yardstick. I mean, the cap does get used during the course of the year, so it still would suggest that there are not enough numbers available because we do expend all the numbers eventually. I think that we'll find that there will be a greater demand on the H-1B cap as the consuls have become much more restrictive in their adjudication of L-1 specialized knowledge and these L-1 blanket petitions that are filed at consulates. And as they become more restrictive, particularly with applications in the computer consulting field, the IT consulting field, software development, et cetera, I think that we'll see the demand go up quite a bit. So I think more numbers are needed. And I also think that some work needs to be done on identifying the perceived problem. There's a perceived problem, and you can see this on Capitol Hill, a lot of things you read emanating from Senator Grassley and others. There's a perceived problem with certain usages of the H&L visas as it applies to, for instance, the persons coming to the U.S. who are going to be working off-site and providing, involved in knowledge transfer, for instance, in the consulting business or other areas where off-site work is necessary in imparting skills to U.S. workers, et cetera. And these very negative interpretations by the USCIS, I think, need to be addressed through some tweaking of the L provision in Congress. So I think you'll see a building constituency of companies who really think that this whole issue of off-site workers coming to the U.S. and the whole offshoring problem is creating a major a confluence of negativity and needs to be sorted out legislatively.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll take our next question from Charlie Erickson with Hispanic Link News Service.
Yeah, thank you. If by some minor miracle a comprehensive immigration policy were to get passed by Congress, what impact would that have on the various procedural and other problems you folks are discussing?
Well, I'm happy to take a shot at it. I mean, usually what would happen if you were to have some sort of legalization program, you'd want to set up almost a separate entity to administer that in a way that it wouldn't have a negative impact on the resources for all the other parts of the immigration system. I mean, that's ideally how you would want to set it up.
Comprehensive isn't just that. Some of these issues would be addressed.
I think the general perception of comprehensive immigration reform is that it would cover a number of different areas, and which ones of the various topics would be impacted by this discussion is really a question of the content of a final proposal. It would no doubt deal with a number of issues. I mentioned the Trusted Employer Program. That could be adopted legislatively as well, and certainly would be on the table and something that we would push for in comprehensive immigration reform. So I think a number of these areas would be touched on, and we know that there are a number of proposals to restrict H&L visas as well as other categories that no doubt would be proposed, which the business community poses. So in any event, it all depends on the content. But as we all know, it's highly unlikely that that's going to occur.
But I think that is a good question, and Austin, just because most of the stuff on CIR, which some of us have been working on for a decade, doesn't go to the sort of processing issue of visas. I mean, they go to the numbers or the recruitment requirements that employers must follow to ensure that there's American not available, et cetera. And putting aside the legalization aspect, which Stuart wisely pointed out, shouldn't be allowed to crowd out the resources for these other areas. You're right, things like the 214B issue would not be affected. I mean, the criteria, you know, the various criteria by which visas are approved hasn't typically been addressed in any of these kind of bills as distinguished from sort of the numbers. So some things would be affected, as Austin put it out, and many others wouldn't be. It's true.
Are you saying minimally?
Wouldn't be.
No, I say, are you saying it would have a minimal impact?
On some areas, and other ones it could have. It depends which one. It depends which recommendation you're talking about. I mean, what I'm saying is that those recommendations that kind of go to the criteria that the State Department uses in processing visas wouldn't be affected. The 214B issue is a good example of something that wouldn't be affected by comprehensive immigration reform.
But you know, you don't see there's a lot of people in this country now who are here undocumented who would benefit from or would improve the opportunities for a better procedural kind of addressing.
Well, they're already here in the country. They would be legalized through a process that both McCain-Kennedy bill and other bills set out. But it would be a separate sort of set of criteria that those people would have, like paying a civil fine of X amount of dollars.
You don't see a lot of fully qualified types of people that you're talking about the need for as being affected by a comprehensive immigration package.
Right, but that's, as I was going to say, that's a separate part of the people who are here now and would be eligible for the legalization process. That's been a different, that's a new legalization process that's been set out in these bills as distinguished from sort of the processes that are on the books now.
Yeah, I understand.
This, Kevin, I just would add, if there were such a bill, that it could force the issue of a larger integration policy for our country. Because if you're going to require, you know, immigrants to learn English as a condition of getting their citizenship, then on the other hand, you need to provide the opportunities for them to do so. So our organization would certainly, if there was a wide-ranging debate, advocate for that, that it has to be an integral part. And it also responds to the American public's concern about integration and cultural fears they may have. If you have a strong integration policy accompanied with a legalization, then they have more assurances that these immigrants are going to integrate more fully.
I think we're up to our 2 o'clock time. If there are any other questions that people have or want to reach any of the people on the call, feel free to respond to one of the emails you likely received to get on the call. And we're happy to answer or any follow-up questions on that. I want to thank everyone for participating in the call and have a good afternoon.